All across Wisconsin from Civic Media, this is Up North News Radio. Real information, good conversation, unabashedly Wisconsin. Here's the founding editor of Up North News, Pat Kreitlow.
Well, hey there. Good morning, Wisconsin. Welcome to the State of Wisconsin Sense for this Thursday, November 10th. It is 66 degrees up here on Lake Wissota. It will be 26 degrees at this time tomorrow morning, a 40 degree drop in 24 hours. And I just checked over in Waukesha, it's 55, and they'll get down to about 25. So it'll be about 30 degrees colder tomorrow morning than it is right now. That's not just for you, as I always say, that's for the kiddies heading out to the bus stop. They're going to feel a little warm there this morning. Don't dress them in the same stuff tomorrow. Coming up this morning, we talked to three friends of the show about the red wave that never quite materialized and what lessons we can learn from the wins and losses in Wisconsin and around the country. We will hear from contributing analyst Joe Zepecki in Milwaukee, Courier Newsroom national correspondent Kiev Akil in Los Angeles, and Brett Pransky from our Pennsylvania sister outlet, The Keystone, to help us make sense of all of Tuesday's results. Now, this is the Thursday after Election Day Tuesday, so be advised that just about anybody who was deeply involved with Election Day, Election Night, and the day after is still sleeping and might until lunchtime today. So yes, all three of these interviews were done yesterday while there was still a little bit of consciousness left in all of them. If you'd like to reach us here, 715-388-7155, or the email address is radio@upnorthnewswi.com. Aaron Zomers is in the producer chair this morning, where we were again comparing notes on just how much sleep deprivation is still left to overcome. But Aaron, you made it in. Congratulations on that, and not leaving me in a lurch here.
Yep.
Or me, the same to you. I've wondered about that. If I'm not here at 6:06, what's your first move?
Well, I will probably pull up a podcast from yesterday and just say we're experiencing some technical difficulties, and then start playing yesterday's episode.
There you go. See, folks, there's your insight. Is if I oversleep and you hear him first things first, and he says it's technical difficulties, no, not at all. That's just somebody forgot to set his alarm last night. Before I passed out entirely, and I tell you, about 8 o'clock, I was there. I watched a little bit of the CMAs. I'm not, of course, I'm not a big country music fan. I'm not opposed to it. I just, you know, don't. I'm an old guy now. I just listen to old guy music, you know, yacht rock and things like that. I'll catch the CMAs now and then, you know, Luke Bryan, Peyton Manning, or just a little too goofball for me, which I know might sound odd, but you know, I mean, they're fine. They're just not, you know, I'm not going to rush to see them like, say, Tina Fey and Amy Poehler, you know, co-hosting an awards show. My only other observation right now on that is to some of these country music acts, I'm going to put country in quotation marks. If you want to be a rock band, just be a rock band. You know, I'm not saying that everything has to be, you know, the pedal guitar and everything has to have a twang to it, but there's a line someplace. And I'm not saying anybody knows exactly where it is, but you know what I'm talking about. Is you look at something and you go, that's on country radio? Really? And you can take a song and you can definitely make it both ways. I mean, there's no end of the list of songs that have, you know, crossed genres, artists that have been able to do different versions that span genres. It's just that sometimes you hear something and you go, I don't know about that. It wouldn't get on top 40 radio necessarily, but is it really country? I will also say that there were some nice tributes to folks out there, people who had passed, of course, like Loretta Lynn, and of course, the fellow from Alabama. There was a great surprise appearance by Jody Messina that maybe we'll talk about a little bit later on. And then that was it for me. I couldn't keep those eyes open much longer. So if there was any drama near the end of the show, I completely missed it. But that was the last that I got for my non-political dose of any kind of information before, you know, being done. As I looked at headlines this morning, trying to get back into the mode of, you know, reactions to the elections, I haven't listened to the clip, but I'm looking at the headline here from Channel 12 in Milwaukee, WISN. Paul Ryan, hey, remember him? Paul Ryan calls former President Donald Trump a drag on our ticket. The former House Speaker told WISN 12 News he thinks Republicans would have been better, had better results on Election Day if Donald Trump wasn't involved. Is Paul Ryan not just the epitome of the dog that only barks until you walk toward him and then he pees himself? He and so many others in the Republican Party talk such a good game about Donald Trump. And then comes the time to actually do something about it, and they turn tail and run. And at some point, you shouldn't even be allowed to have a microphone put in your face to be able to say, oh, yeah, yeah, that Donald Trump, he's terrible. So are you going to do something about it? No, I've got this conference I've got to go to. Sorry, I've got to get back. But that, of course, didn't stop him. He said, I think we're going to have to do a lot of soul searching, head scratching, looking through and parsing the numbers as to why we didn't perform as well as we would have liked to. Ron Johnson got reelected. I'm very happy to see that. It was a mixed blessing, but we should have done that better than we did. Aaron, do you have that clip of Ron Johnson handy from that I asked you to keep in mind? We mentioned it yesterday. I just want to play it again so that I can again have the proper reaction. Ron?
But again, those lies, when you have a political party that has no problem lying, where they figure the end justifies the means, unfortunately, that has an impact in politics.
Yeah, Ron, we know. We'll be right back. That has an impact. Kiev Akil, nice to have you here. Thanks again for joining us on Up North News Radio.
You bet. Good to be back.
Well, there's a lot to look back on here, and we will hit several states, a little bit less on Pennsylvania, just because we're going to talk to our friend Brett Pransky in a little while as well. But overall, there was talk of a red wave and then a red tsunami or a red mirage and, of course, the blue wall and everything else. And what we ended up with was not any kind of a red wave. It certainly wasn't. I mean, Republicans will still probably take the House very narrowly, but, you know, there wasn't this tsunami that people were thinking just a month ago. What are your first best guesses as to, you know, how that came to be?
Yeah. You know, like you said, unless no tsunami anywhere outside of Florida, you know, Florida went very red, but everywhere else, Democrats were competitive. They have an outside shot at still winning the House and are probably slightly favored in the Senate. And I think there's a couple of reasons. I think one, we saw in the last couple of weeks, a lot of Republican polling firms kind of flooding the public with polls that found their candidates winning. And those are nonpartisan polls. And so that, I think, created a media narrative that, oh, Republicans are heavily favored. So I think that's one thing. I think the second thing is a lot of conventional wisdom in Washington, on the East Coast, and, you know, political circles was that this was going to be all about inflation, that inflation was the thing everyone cared about. Nothing else really matters. And if something else mattered, it's crime. And, you know, I think what yesterday's and today's and continued results are showing is that, yes, people care about inflation. To some extent, they care about crime as an election issue, but they also care about a lot of other things. They care about abortion rights. That's overwhelmingly carried in the way in Michigan and even in Kentucky. And then the other thing is young voters just turned out in huge numbers all across the country. And overwhelmingly, by like a 2-to-1 margin, voted for Democrats. That's in House races, but safe to assume that that's a similar ratio in other races.
Mm-hmm. What are we looking at in Arizona and Nevada as we're recording this late Wednesday are still out, and is that a normal function of how they tally things up in those Western states?
Yes, it is. So in Arizona, what's left right now are what are called the late earlies, which sounds crazy, but is essentially early ballots that were mailed back or dropped off between late last week and Election Day. So those are being counted. They're doing, I think, two updates a day. So we should have a pretty good sense of that within the next few days, of who has won. In most of those races, there might be some that take into next week. And in Nevada, same exact situation where it's mail ballots. Nevada expanded mail voting in between the 2020 and 22 elections, so everyone could vote by mail, which means there are tens of thousands, unknown exactly how many, but mail ballots left to be counted, especially in the Las Vegas area. And so that will take into next week, most likely. And so what that means is that we may not know who controls the Senate until late this week, early next week, and or December, if, you know, if those two are split. And then the House is really going to come down to those states and California, which could take 3 weeks to count all its ballots, 4 weeks. So there's going to be a period of uncertainty, but it's going to be whichever party wins the House or the Senate, it'll be by, in the Senate, probably one seat or a tie. And then in the House, 5 to 6 at most.
Okay. In terms of the blue wall in Wisconsin, we're feeling a little bit like, you know, we're on the outside looking in as we look at Democratic trifecta control in Minnesota, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, if I'm not mistaken, which just leads to not so much a question, but a comment that gerrymandering is one hell of a drug.
It really is. And I think in Pennsylvania, the Republicans still have the state Senate. And Democrats are on the verge of winning the state House, all but confirmed. But yeah, I mean, Wisconsin, it's gerrymandering. That's the only, it's a 50-50 state. Republicans won the Senate race. Democrats won the governor's race. Republican, the Secretary of State's race at last glance, I believe, is still too close to call. And then Josh Call won the AG's race very narrowly. So it's a 50-50 state, but Republicans are winning 60-some% of legislative and Senate seats because they've drawn the maps in a way that's rigged. And they have, there's no real recourse for Democrats until the state Supreme Court elections next year. So,
and that won't be mild by any stretch of the imagination. I mean, nominating papers can be taken out in 3 weeks. So there's only going to be a brief respite there. Can you talk a bit about Georgia and the runoff? It's something that we don't have here in Wisconsin. And I don't know, I'm not going to pass judgment if the system is good or bad, but because there was a third candidate who got what, maybe 3% of the vote, we got to go through this all over again in Georgia just like 2 years ago?
Yeah, I believe it's just under 2%. The Libertarian candidate, Chase Oliver, got in Georgia. And because of the way Georgia election law is written, that means it goes to runoff again. And it could decide, we don't know if it'll decide the Senate control. It very well could. And so, yeah, I believe it's December 6th, which means we have, you know, 1 month of uncertainty as opposed to two, like we did in 2020, 2021. But yeah, not many states have a runoff law as far as, I don't know the exact number, but, you know, you see a lot of candidates winning with under 50% because their states don't have runoff laws. And if we don't know how Georgia would have broken down if not for Chase Oliver, but if they didn't have a runoff law, Raphael Warnock would be in the Senate right now, would be reelected.
Although I will say, and again, just personal reflection, but 2 years ago, I think the runoffs actually helped with Warnock and the other Senate race as well, because voters had that time to focus on just those two and to make it a binary choice. I'm not guaranteeing a Warnock win by any stretch, but I just have a feeling another month of voters looking at Herschel Walker isn't the best prescription for Herschel Walker's political future.
No, it's definitely not. And, you know, Walker trailed Brian Kemp, who won his reelection quite easily as the Republican in Georgia for governor. And so there was a lot of split ticket voters who voted for Brian Kemp and then Raphael Warnock, or who voted for Brian Kemp and didn't vote in the Senate race. And so Brian Kemp will not be on the ballot in December, which means Herschel Walker is going to have to appeal to enough voters to get 50% plus one vote. And we don't know that he can do that. We know Raphael Warnock can do that historically. But again, that's not to say this, it'll be very close. Whoever wins will win by under a percentage point, most likely. So you'd have to say Warnock is probably a slight favorite, but anything can happen in just a runoff.
And then there's Iowa, which I guess we tend to almost dismiss it as so safely Republican, but then every so often we get these glimmers of optimism. And when you hear that a retired admiral is running against Chuck Grassley, you think, okay, maybe this is the time. But instead, Iowa is sending an 89-year-old back. At least give credit to our sister publication, Iowa Starting Line, for reminding people Chuck Grassley's been around for a while, and he's not the fresh, bold leader that perhaps Iowa needs.
Yeah, I mean, he's been around since the Eisenhower era, before my parents were born. So,
he predates the invention of the chocolate chip cookie. That is the greatest thing that Iowa Starting Line could do, is make those comparisons about how long that he is closer to the presidency of, what was it, Benjamin Harrison than Joe Biden based on his birth. I mean, again, we're not talking about age discrimination so much as we're saying he's been around for a while, and we don't know, if he's within that 6 years going to say, I'm tired. And then the governor gets to appoint somebody instead of the people choosing who they want.
Yeah. And his son is a politician in Iowa. So there's a pretty good, there's a non-zero chance that his son fills his seat but going back to what you were saying. Yeah. I mean, Iowa, it's hard to look at it and say right now it's not a red state, but one of the upsides of this year feels like Democrats just bottoming out there. I don't know how much worse it can get. So the upside of that is there's nowhere to go but up. And, I have a feeling there's going to be a lot of introspection and changes made in Iowa among the Democratic Party and activists there, the same way that needs to happen in Florida, which now is more red than Texas by all estimates from yesterday's results, which is just crazy. When things are going that poorly in those places, you have to just try something else. And it's going to take years probably to turn that around. But Iowa's not a lost cause. I mean, Franken did okay. And, there are some glimmers of hope there.
In Michigan, meanwhile, Democrats dominated, which surprised me given the rhetoric of the Michigan Republicans. It seemed like they were, motivated, and it was all torches and pitchforks and everything. And yet it didn't turn out that way, perhaps because, as we've discussed, they didn't necessarily have their best candidates due to a nominating petition signature scandal. And I guess I'm left wondering if but for that one event, would the entire complexion of Michigan be different on this post-election day?
It's possible. I think you have to acknowledge that that's a genuine possibility. Tudor Dixon, who was the top of the ticket in Michigan, was a very flawed candidate. That said, the overwhelming youth turnout in Michigan, Proposal 3, which enshrined abortion rights in the state constitution, those were passed significantly. The youth turnout was huge. You see women turning out in huge numbers. I really feel like abortion played the defining role in those races, in addition to candidate quality. Mm-hmm. So, if James Craig, who was presumably would have been the nominee had he not had that petition issue, been the nominee, I think he probably would have kept it within 5 points, as opposed to, I believe it's 9 or 10 Whitmer is winning by as of last look. But Michigan had, the Democratic slate is really strong there, and the Republican slate was just MAGA candidates who appeal to no one but the Republican base.
Right. And again, now you put the Dobbs decision on top of that, and that truly is the story of the 2022 elections. Kia Vakil, thanks so much. We appreciate all your help letting us see what else is happening around the country.
You bet. Anytime.
And so bringing the focus back here to Wisconsin, again, when we talk about turnout, it should be a longer discussion, and looking at multiple pieces, not just Milwaukee, but also, Dane County and the rest of the state, some of the cities within the state. So with that disclaimer said, the turnout in Milwaukee, based on these first numbers that I'm seeing, are pretty damning. Ron Johnson beat Mandela Barnes by 27,000 votes, a very narrow victory, 27,000 votes. And yet in the city of Milwaukee alone, turnout was 40,000 voters lower than 4 years ago when Mandela Barnes was on the ballot as well, running for lieutenant governor. A 40,000 vote drop-off in turnout in the city of Milwaukee and 70% turnout versus 80% 4 years ago. Again, it's not the full statewide picture, but it's one of those questions we've got to ask about where the voters are in these various races. We'll have more. We'll talk about Pennsylvania numbers with our friend from the Keystone next. You're up north. You can buy dirt.
Follow Up North News online anytime. Search Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter for Up North News WI and our homepage, upnorthnewswi.com.
And talk to us about asking the U.S. Department of Education to go after predatory private schools that forced students into unnecessarily expensive loans while offering nearly worthless diplomas. We'll also talk to Courier Newsroom political director Carolyn Fidler, former Chicago Tribune editor Mark Jacob, and UW-Eau Claire athletic director Dan Schumacher. We'll preview the weekend in sports. Again, if you want to reach us, 715-388-7155. All right, next we're going to hear from Brett Pransky of our sister publication, The Keystone, out in Pennsylvania, part of Courier Newsroom. We talked yesterday. They had two big races out there, same as here, a governor's race and a U.S. Senate race. And in the governor's race, the Democrat, Josh Shapiro, won over an insurrection candidate, Doug Mastriano, on the Republican side. And of course, the big race everybody knows about there was the U.S. Senate race between TV's Dr. Oz and Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman. So I started by asking him, even though there are a lot of issues like abortion and inflation and protecting democracy, it must have been that the Senate race took up all of the oxygen because of the characters on the ballot in Dr. Oz and John Fetterman. Will we look back and see that Pennsylvania, all of Pennsylvania's outcomes, were in fact framed or under the umbrella of this nationally watched U.S. Senate race?
Yeah, I think they kind of were. I mean, because there were so many ups and downs involved in it. I mean, there aren't too many times that in the middle of a race, a candidate has a life-threatening condition that then he recovers from through the race. It threw a wrinkle into it that no one was really expecting. And it really kind of, you know, the doubts about Fetterman's health are probably one of the big reasons that the Oz campaign was able to keep itself going. Because if you remember, they were down huge early on. There was no indication that was going to change.
There's been a lot of discussion, though, about the quality of the candidates and the impact of Trump and his endorsements. Certainly, we've discussed how in Michigan, not all of the strongest candidates emerged from the primary, Arizona as well. Mastriano came out of a crowded primary in the gubernatorial race there. So to what extent was the Trump factor playing a role in the inevitable November outcomes?
I think it was a pretty, you know, it was a pretty massive factor. I mean, there would not have been a Doug Mastriano without Donald Trump's endorsement. And to be honest, a more mainstream Republican, I don't know if anybody was going to beat Shapiro. He's a strong candidate, ran a strong race, has wide support throughout the state. I don't know if anyone was going to beat him. But, you know, they could have done a lot better. You know, then, and plus, I think Mastriano was probably a drag on the rest of the ticket too. If you look down ballot, you know, there are a lot of congressional races that were won that were, you know, expected to go the Republicans' way. The Pennsylvania State House flipped. They just announced that this afternoon. And I think a lot of this has to do with the fact that the top of the ticket was particularly weak. You know, and was just a candidate that no one could get behind because of his ridiculously extreme views.
There's a lot of, shall we say, jealous looks coming from Wisconsin toward Pennsylvania, toward Michigan, toward Minnesota, where there is increased and consolidated Democratic control, whereas Republicans here in Wisconsin, starting in 2011, were able to rig the maps to the point and take over state Supreme Court seats to the point where, you know, they've got this artificial majority that they're going to have for some time. Is there anything in particular that Pennsylvania Democrats, you know, did right that Wisconsin Democrats could learn from in terms of working their way back into power again? Or are we simply dealt a bad hand by the gerrymandering that we have here?
Well, I think it's a bit of both. There's probably things that people, you know, that people can learn from Pennsylvania, and actually, you know, learn from Fetterman and Shapiro and kind of how they ran their campaigns, especially the Fetterman campaign. And again, with, you know, with having someone whose, you know, Pennsylvania credentials were pretty suspect, you know, in Dr. Oz to run against, that idea of being, you know, quote unquote from here, you know, carried weight in ways that it doesn't in a lot of other places. But then again, we talk about, you know, maps being gerrymandered and things like that. It's a problem in Pennsylvania too, but not to the same degree as it is in some other states. Ohio is really terrible. Wisconsin has some difficult maps. And, you know, this has really been a big problem in these races going back to, well, it was probably about 2009, 2010, during what the Republicans called the Red State Project, where they started pumping all their money in the state legislature so that they could, you know, essentially win by redrawing the lines.
We've said here that part of the reason that Governor Tony Evers was able to win re-election was his authenticity. Now, again, he and John Fetterman aren't exactly one and the same person, but they're both very authentic people. And you work with, you know, radio show host Rick Smith, again, right, who's all about bringing that working class authenticity back to politics. So as you and Rick discuss, you know, the Fetterman victory and others, do you feel like there are lessons there for future Democratic candidates to take away when it comes to how you communicate with voters and maybe listen a little less to consultants?
Yeah, I would. Yeah, that's putting it nicely.
Yes, I am.
I say you take the consultants and you drop them off a cliff. Mm-hmm. You got to be able to talk to working people. I mean, and this is one thing, again, we just finished that 30-day tour all over the upper Midwest, where we sat down with people in, you know, city after city after city of factory towns all over, you know, all over the Midwest. And we heard the same thing from all of them. They're concerned with how to put food on the table. They're concerned with the fact that, you know, the one job can no longer support a family. In fact, in many cases, two jobs can't support a family. Now we have parents who not only are they both working, but sometimes both are working multiple jobs in order to get by. These are things that matter to people on an everyday basis. And if you can speak to these issues, and these are the things that some of these candidates are talking about, putting working people first. Take, say, the Tim Ryan campaign. Now, it wasn't enough to get over the top, but he got a lot closer than he would have been, you know, if he had just done the kind of, you know, straight consultant messaging and, you know, relying on social issues and things like that. Kitchen table issues work. They always have. And it's what I think the party needs to get back to, at least in, you know, in certain areas.
So we then turn the corner here and we look ahead because, well, first, that's what we do. But second, there are people already talking about 2024. It will be a presidential election year here in Wisconsin. We assume Tammy Baldwin will be running for a third term at that point as well. And unlike these first 2 years where Joe Biden could put forward the American Rescue Plan, he could eventually hammer out a bipartisan infrastructure bill, maybe the odds aren't that high that we're going to see a lot of legislative achievement coming off of Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. So the question becomes, what are you running on in 2024? What is the messaging? Because it may not be actual legislative accomplishments. So what are the things that you think Democrats actually need to start talking about even now and throughout 2023 to make 2024 more successful?
Honestly, you know, and kind of ironically, I would say legislative achievements. And here's why. While we passed a lot of these bills, most of them, in fact, a number of them haven't spent a penny yet. The effects of these bills and what's going to happen, you know, as these things, you know, begin to affect people's lives, the results of this legislation hasn't been realized yet. And over the next year, year and a half, 2 years, those outcomes are going to present themselves in a way that's going to allow us to, you know, to take that victory lap, because we're going to be able to point to the new things being built and the new jobs being created, you know, in the new manufacturing plants coming back to several states as a result of this legislation. So I think that those legislative victories were great in the first 2 years. In the second 2 years, we need to be doing victory laps on the results of that legislation.
Looking as well at the, you know, the Twitter account that comes through the Rick Smith show, you know, you're noting, you know, even this week while we're talking about election results, still talking about, you know, wage theft and misclassification. These are big issues, you know, for folks especially who are not in union labor. We're seeing that growth. Again, admittedly, in small places like coffee shops, but we're seeing young people embracing the need for collective bargaining in the workplace. We saw how big they turned out this time around on election day. So that sure seems to me like labor issues can be talked about to try to grow even further this younger cohort of voters coming on the scene.
Oh, that's true. And I think we're probably going to see some of that, you know, for example, and when you look at the results of the midterm election, one thing that isn't getting a whole lot of press outside of Illinois, but is still, you know, a big issue is I can't remember exactly what they called it. It wasn't a worker bill of rights, but there was a codifying of, you know, of collective bargaining rights on the ballot in Illinois, and it won. So right to work is banned constitutionally in the state of Illinois. And I think this is something that needs to be replicated in, you know, in more and more states around the country. Again, union labor has a higher approval rating now than it has since the 1960s. I think it's at 70-71%, something like that. And it's much higher than that among young people, you know, who have been staring down the barrel of some pretty scary economic numbers for a very long time. And so they're seeing this as an opportunity to take back a little power, democratize their workplaces. And I think there's ways that we can legislate around that too and really get them fired up.
And in fact, we learned late Wednesday that with Michigan Democrats taking the legislature for the full legislature for the first time in something like 40 years, repealing the misnamed right to work laws on the books there will be one of the first things out of the gates for them. And so, again, this talking to young people this year was primarily around, you know, student loan debt and to a lesser degree health care. But yeah, you're right. If we can now carry this into workplace issues, then I think you have a chance to actually build a coalition for the future rather than all this short-term planning about the next election. This is, you know, too much of my generation, late baby boomer, early, you know, Gen X is sadly, you know, lost. But I think a lot of people have identified in this new bunch of voters the ways to show that government can work for them, that it's not some kind of a lost cause, as part of my generation believes who grew up with Ronald Reagan.
No, true. In fact, you know, the Reagan generation forward, you start talking about the dismantling of American manufacturing, bad trade deals, and, you know, really just crippling, you know, the American worker. And, you know, the middle class has been shrinking and shrinking and shrinking, you know, for generations now. The possibility of being able to build that back again, you know, they call it the American dream for a reason, you know, and with for too many people for too long now, that American dream, you know, just hasn't come true. You know, the idea is if you work hard, play by the rules, you'll get ahead. But for too many people, they work hard, play by the rules, and the get ahead part just never happens. You know, a lot of hardworking people out there who just can't get by. And the more that happens, the more people are going to reach for that. And whoever is willing to give that to them, you know, or give them what they have earned, are the ones who are gonna have the loyalty of the next generation. And, you know, it really should be the Democrats.
Brett, we appreciate that Pennsylvania perspective. Thank you so much.
No, thank you very much.
And we'll continue these conversations tomorrow. More reaction from the campaigns when we talk to Carolyn Fiddler, political editorial director for Courier Newsroom, about, again, the issues that resonated with voters and the ones that resonated that, you know, the chattering class thought would not, that passions would die out. It's part of an article I'm going to post at upnorthnewswi.com right after the show about my own takeaways from, you know, the 2022 campaign, not just what we learned, but also, you know, what we should be watching for as we ramp up not only for 2024, but also for 2023. I laughed actually getting a text message late yesterday. Didn't you think all the text messages were going to be done now that the votes have been counted? There'd be a break? No. I got a text message from one of the candidates for state Supreme Court who's going to be running in February and then maybe again in April if they come out of the primary. It's here, folks. And don't shrug it off. Don't walk away. The Supreme Court election is going to be huge. We'll talk more about that later today and tomorrow as well. Time for a break. Then we'll have This Day in History, Music and Otherwise with Sesame Street and more next. This is Up North News. On November 10th, 1969, the debut of Sesame Street for an audience of little hooligans like me. That was my year of kindergarten, and I remember hearing all about there was going to be this brand new show just for kids on public TV, and I remember going home from school and watching that and liking it from day one, whether it was because of Oscar the Grouch or Cookie Monster. You know, who's to say? Although for me, it was always Grover. And the fact that Grover has pretty much been replaced by Elmo is a damn shame. Because Grover was one of the comedy greats in this country of ours.
I am going to have to agree with you because I know my older sister and I, she's about 5.5 years older. I'm 23, but I also, just to give you, you know, a sense that this show is still going. I think kids are still watching it now, but I know I watched it all the time. Grover was definitely one of my favorites as well. So,
When we set up the 3-year-old grandson with Sesame Street through HBO Max, we made sure to, you know, play clips because they have all the old shows on there too through the app, and we definitely play plenty of that. Let's go to music from the Eagles, 1979. The Eagles had their fifth and final number one hit in the U.S. before their rather contentious breakup, shall we say, in 1980. But on this day in 1979, they hit number one with Heartache Tonight. And if you've never seen the Eagles documentary, and I don't know where you would find it now. I think it was on Showtime originally. It's so good. And including, you know, the footage of them basically breaking up on stage right there in 1980 and thinking, well, they're never going to get back together. And sure enough, they did eventually. We were happy to play Sesame Street music and the Eagles so that we wouldn't have to play Gordon Lightfoot singing The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald, which is, I mean, it's beautiful. It's haunting, but not really what we're looking for on a happy morning radio show. The Edmund Fitzgerald sank on this day in 1975. And again, it was for that particular generation, it was striking because, again, people were saying, what? I didn't think ships sank anymore, you know, just, you know, sink in the middle of a storm. And yeah, we understand storms are big on Lake Superior, but it was a real shock to folks. David Bowie's Space Oddity was released on this day in 1969 to complement the Apollo 11 moon landing. It hit number one on the UK singles chart, and it featured Rick Wakeman of the progressive rock band Yes on synthesizers. Also, birthday this day would be the U.S. Marine Corps from this day in 1775. In 1973, Elton John's best-selling album at over 15 million copies worldwide, Goodbye Yellow Brick Road, hit number one on the U.S. album charts and stayed there for 8 weeks. It, of course, featured Benny and the Jets, Saturday Night's All Right for Fighting, and so much more. Birthdays, Miranda Lambert is 39 today. Saw her on the Country Music Awards last night. Her fifth album, Platinum, topped the U.S. album chart on this day in 2014. Let's see. Warren G is 52 today, born on this day in 1970. And then I have to admit, you know, Grandpa does not know one of the birthdays that Aaron set up for us here. Is it Chris? How do you say Chris's last name here from Silverchair?
Joanu, I think. I haven't heard it in a long time, honestly. I mostly just know the band, not the individuals.
But you know Silverchair, the Australian rock band that had four number one albums in Australia, most notably the 1995 record Frog Stomp is what you have here. And I'm going to have to believe you because, as I've said, I'm very aware of not trying to pull a Ron Burgundy and just reading what anybody puts in the teleprompter. I've known people to do that. And there is no worse feeling as a news anchor than having something come up in the prompter and you realize, holy crap, I forgot to pre-read that one. Let's see, what was the steroid scandal? What's the steroid that Mark McGuire was using? It was androstenedione. And I don't know why I did not catch that before. And what came out of my mouth sounded like, you know, Porky Pig in you know, a Looney Tunes cartoon. So I just wanted to make sure and put Aaron on record that you're the one that told me about this band and this birthday, and you wouldn't fool old Pat here and just throw something fictitious in on me.
That's correct. Frog Stomp may sound like a fake name, and it may sound like a fake name I would come up with, but it is real.
Okay, good. Thank you very much. So that's this day in history. There will be a little bit of history made at American Family Field tomorrow night when the Badger basketball teams get back into action. Regular season started this week, and the men's Badger basketball team will be playing Stanford, and the Badger women will play Kansas State, but they won't be playing in Madison. They won't be playing on campus. They'll be in Milwaukee, playing at American Family Field. Basketball court's been set up across the baseball diamond. Some seating's been put up. The women will play at 3:30. The men will play at 6:30. There was some discussion that, you know, maybe this was, you know, apart from being something, you know, novel, is it something that could American Family Field at some point be a venue for the Final Four? And the answer's got to be no. There's this baseball season that also takes place around that time of year, so it's probably not terribly workable. But, you know, never say never. You know, that could certainly, you know, maybe the Brewers go on a long enough road trip, you know, that could be the case. While we were doing music, I'd mentioned yesterday, and I think we'll play the clips during the next hour. But I was familiar with Jody Messina's Heads Carolina, Tails California from 1996, again, dating myself. I did not know until last night that Cole Swindell does kind of a follow-up to it at She Had Me at Heads Carolina. And again, you know, not typically a country person and somebody of a particular age now. I heard him mentioning Heads Carolina, and about halfway through the song, I'm like, this isn't the same song. This must be like some kind of a tribute to the song. And then Jody Messina comes up near the end and they kind of do a mashup of the two hits. And I thought that was very cool that they put that together, and the crowd clearly liked it. And so that just made me happy. And there was a touching moment as well when the group Old Dominion won the CMA for Vocal Group of the Year for the fifth time. And it was nice of them to talk about being in a band and shouting out to Jeff Cook of Alabama. Mike Ramsey, lead singer for Old Dominion, noted that, you know, country music had lost a lot of legends. And he said, we wouldn't be here without Alabama and Jeff Cook. And it got him thinking how grateful it is to be in a band, grateful to have friends. Can't imagine losing one of you guys. Happy to be able to make music and be honored. We love you. We love the opportunity to doing what we're doing. And we just thank you. They were taking note of the founding member and guitarist from Alabama, Jeff Cook, who passed away on Monday at the age of 73 years old. So, you know, again, we stretch between, you know, one band, the Eagles, breaking up live on stage, and another band being thankful in the moment for what they've got. Joseph Pecky will help us make sense of Tuesday's election results coming up in the next hour. First, our little break for news at the top of the hour, and then back after this is Up North News Radio.